Quick reminder before the show, if you haven't checked out the Intensive Care Academy over at ICU101.com, you probably should. That's Brian and my other project. Lots of video-based lessons on all kinds of critical care topics. We are working through right now a CQ program for those of you doing surgical stuff and about to crack open the neuro and cardiac ICUs, as well as tons of foundational stuff, all kinds of procedural courses, and a couple of private podcast feeds, not unlike this one. Check it out if you haven't, ICU101.com. Otherwise, to the show. Hey everyone, I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world. Salutations, podcast listeners. It is Brandon, back here with Brian.
Hola.
We are guest-free this week. I know a bit of a rarity these days, but I feel like we've been kind of sleeping on guestless episodes because there's some good foundational kind of stuff that we can probably be highlighting. And that's what we want to do this week. We want to talk about how to talk, the conversation. And one of the most important and common and I think easily goofed up procedures we do in the ICU, I think, is simply the conversation, which is usually involving a family member of a patient. Could be the patient, but a lot of ours are not talking so much. And it's about what to do in the setting of critical illness, maybe the end of life, sometimes euphemistically called a goals of care conversation, which is what it is, but it's sort of a catchphrase too, which is, I mean, to be completely honest, is often you telling people you're not sure someone is going to live and what do they want to do about that. But how to have this conversation is a real art and science, I guess. It's an everyday part of our job, but is, I think, often not taught well, if at all. I mean, how many new folks starting critical care really get serious education on this? Maybe they get to see it once or twice if they're lucky, but you can easily do it wrong. I mean, you say the wrong stuff, people will remember this forever, or you will really alter the direction of care, maybe in ways that you didn't want or can't take back. So you can talk about principles and how it should be done. If you ever get the chance to hang out with a good palliative care service or learn from some of their resources, that is awesome. But we thought, why don't we just do it? So we're going to mock up a simulated conversation in the typical context you might encounter. Brian is going to be the bedside provider, the APP in this case, taking care of a sick patient, and I'm going to be the family member that he is interacting with. And we'll try to kind of just give an example, illustrate what this can look like, not necessarily the best way. I mean, I'm sure there's open for a debate, but at least how Brian does it, at least one of the ways. And you can start to kind of see what that means to you and figure out how you can incorporate this into your practice. So we'll chat as if we were there. We might have a couple of conversations because that often is how this goes. Then we'll try to debrief it a little and unpack some of what was done and why.
Yeah, this is something that I developed a real interest for kind of early on in my practice because I did see it done so poorly so often. And like you said, not through any fault of anyone necessarily, just it's a skill that we're not really taught. And we wouldn't expect someone to come in on day one, having never been shown how to put a central line in, to go put a central line in. But we kind of do that with this, right? Or maybe you saw one time, maybe you've done one, and then now you're just kind of on your own, right? And you wouldn't go through, you know, years of practice in the ICU just going, I learned how to do a central line once, and that's fine. And I don't need to refine it. I don't need to worry. You know, yeah, I hate doing them because it's so uncomfortable. It's so awkward. But it's something you just got to get through, right? You would never take that approach to any other procedure. So I think we should have that same thought process with something like this, right? It can be very awkward. It can be very difficult to get through. But, you know, you do a lot of these. And so my philosophy kind of early on was, I'm going to have to do these. I might as well work on getting good at it and trying to make it less painful.
Yeah, and 1,000% this is a more complicated procedure than a central line. I mean, I think that's hard to dispute. So let's set the table. Let's say that the patient's a 80-year-old female with a handful of typical comorbidities, maybe most importantly, mild dementia, some cognitive decline in recent years, still lives at home with help from one of her kids with kind of everyday stuff, fairly independent, but clearly kind of not quite what she used to be. And she was found down at home on the floor. They brought her to the hospital here. They scanned her head, and she has like a 3-ish centimeter intraparenchymal hemorrhage, you know, originating from the thalamus, let's say. She was obtunded, rousable to just pain when she came, so she got intubated for her mental status. There's nothing really planned as far as an intervention, just supportive things like controlling her blood pressure. I think this is just a hypertensive bleed. And it's that first day. Family is not really engaged with the team yet, maybe just basic information. And now Brian's going to try to grapple with it. So I guess, let's say I'm the son.
So I think the way to do this is we'll just sort of walk through the conversation, right? Role play a little bit. And then we'll talk, Brandon and I both kind of talk about kind of how we do things. He can kind of say maybe things he does different than the way I've demonstrated it and vice versa. And then just sort of walk through kind of why we do things the way we do and how best to handle these things. So I would start off by sort of setting the stage. And I think this is something that we don't talk enough about in this because we just jump into the conversation. But I think there is some pre-work to be done. And I think the first thing to do is to make sure that everybody involved is on the same page. So in a case like this, right? So I'm an ICU provider. This woman has suffered an intraparenchymal hemorrhage. She's probably, in my shop, would be followed by neurology. She may be followed by a different team where you are. But I think the most important thing is first to talk with them and make sure that we're in agreement. So that when I go in to start talking about prognosis and what would your mom want and things like that, the neurology team's not going to come in 2 hours later and tell a different story. And I don't mean that in like a nefarious way, but I just mean because we're not in agreement. You know, maybe the neurologists are extremely optimistic and the ICU team is extremely pessimistic, in which case we got to find a way to either agree or meet in the middle or something, because we don't want that confusion. So I would do that first. The next thing I would do would be to sort of set the stage. Now, at this point, if I'm just meeting him for the first time, and this is potentially just going to be a, hey, let's talk about how your mom is doing and kind of what would she want if A, B, and C, then I think it's probably just fine for me to go in and talk to the family. If this is a, hey, I have some really devastating news. Your mom is not going to survive, period. Then I probably want to get chaplaincy involved, maybe even go ahead and get the hospice team, depending on what we think the prognosis is looking like and stuff. But for this one, I think I would probably just go in. And usually this conversation is prompted, I feel like more often than not, by the nurse coming to me and saying, hey, the family's here and they have questions. Right. So that we'll presume that. So I would go in and introduce myself first. And I think this is a key step that we forget. In a time like this, it's usually easier to remember because it's the first time you're meeting them. But you have to remember that families meet a lot of people. And just because you've talked to this family every day for the past 3 weeks doesn't mean they know who you are. And so I always say you should go ahead and introduce yourself. I used to joke with students and say, you know, if you ever listen to any songs by Jason Derulo, the artist Jason Derulo, at the opening of literally every song I've ever heard by this guy, he says his name, right? And so if Jason Derulo can introduce himself at the top of every song, be like Jason Derulo and introduce yourself. So,
all right. Well, so, I'll introduce myself. I'm the son, let's say. Maybe there's other family here as well. But
yeah, and that's another good point is always ask, never assume, right? I have been burned by this and I have colleagues who have been burned by this, assuming that this person is the patient's daughter and when in fact it's his wife. Or vice versa. That's the even worse mistake. But you don't want to assume, and you don't want to assume that everybody in the room wants to be included in this conversation, right? Sometimes maybe it's a neighbor who drove them here to the hospital, and the family's like, I mean, we really don't want to have this discussion in front of, I mean, Bob is a nice guy, but he doesn't really know us. He's just doing us a favor. So I'd start off, hi, I'm Brian Bowling. I'm one of the nurse practitioners here in the ICU. And just who is everybody here? And so I know.
I'm Brandon. I'm the son. This is Sarah, my sister. We're the family.
Okay, great. So I just kind of wanted to take a minute to introduce myself and to talk about your mom and her situation. Is this a good time to talk?
Yeah. What's going on?
Okay. So first thing I'd like to is just for you to kind of walk me through, what's your understanding of the situation? What have you been told? And what do you understand about what's going on?
Well, you know, I found her on the floor this morning. You know, it was kind of normal day yesterday, and then I got up for breakfast this morning and I found her, and then she was just kind of groaning and not talking, and I called the ambulance and they brought her to here. We usually go across town, but and then they scanned her head, and they said there was bleeding. And I noticed that she's on the ventilator. But that's all we've heard.
So let me pause here and say, I asked this question because two reasons. One, I want to know what they've been told or what they know, because one, if they've not been told something that's potentially, you know, devastating news or very upsetting news, I want to know that they don't know that yet. Right. Not that I'm going to withhold that, but because when I tell them, I want to be prepared for the fact that this is a bombshell, right? This is not something that they're already anticipating. Also, just to sort of figure out, you know, what do I not need to worry about repeating or going into detail about? And then the other second big reason for asking this is I have them restated in their own words so I can hear how they talk. So Brandon used the word ventilator, right? That tells me he probably has a little bit of knowledge and understanding, whether he's in the medical field or whether he just knows enough to know what this thing is called, right? If they say something like the respirator or the breathing machine, then I know they probably have a little bit less medical knowledge. And so I can kind of tailor that, because it is, frankly, it's a little almost embarrassing. I've had this happen to me before where I start a conversation using extremely simplistic terms, only to find out the person I'm talking to is a surgeon or something, you know? And I go, oh, okay, great. Well, I don't want to act like I'm talking down to you. But at the same time, I don't want to say things like vasopressors, interparenchymal hemorrhage, ventilator, you know, et cetera. If I'm talking to somebody who didn't graduate high school and doesn't have any concept of what those words mean, because a lot of times people if they don't understand, will just nod. Right? Because they don't want to seem dumb or uneducated, so they don't say, I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, the one caveat I would add is that in general, you're probably always safer to err on the side of over-explaining things, because you never quite know. I mean, unless you're dealing with like an intensivist who you work with or something, you literally know their exact background, you never know how much gap there is. Maybe they're a nurse. Okay. But a nurse in wound care, and there's a lot of difference in what you do. Maybe they have some involvement in critical care, but like a different specialty, or maybe they just don't know this exact disease. You never, and then they may not, you know, tell you when there is a gap. So I always just kind of err on the side of over explaining, because frankly, in medicine, we tend to go the other way. We're like, oh, so the this and the that and the this, and it was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, and that's a good point, because I have had a number of conversations with people who, you know, they start using some sort of big words like ventilator. Yeah, that means he probably knows a little something, but you can pick that up from watching Grey's Anatomy. You know, but if you started using words like, I don't know, vasopressors is probably one that you haven't heard before, or things that, then I would say, oh, are you in the healthcare field? And I've had people before tell me, oh, yes, I'm a nurse. And then you dig a little deeper and you find out, well, they're really a nurse's aide. Or they're a nurse, but they're a nurse in, I'm gonna put it in quotes, air quotes, if you can't see, because they're really a medical assistant, like a CMA in a pediatrician's office, something like that. And so like Brandon said, just because they're in healthcare doesn't mean that they understand. We lose sight of that. I used to have a friend who was a dentist, and we would talk about stuff, and I would start saying things, and all of a sudden he would go, "I don't know what you're talking about. You know, that's kind of out of my realm."
And I'll tell people who are in medicine, listen, I'm going to kind of explain this the way I would to anyone. You know, don't think I'm dumbing it down or anything. I just want to make sure there's no gaps or anything, because they're going to be, some of it's going to be like, oh yeah, this is obvious. But like the thing that you didn't think there might be a gap, you're making sure to explain. So,
yeah. Yeah. I think that's a good point. And I think, like you said, err on the side of over explaining. But, you know, asking them to sort of recap for you what they know is a good way to kind of get the ball rolling and start off. So I would pick it up then and say, yeah, that's a pretty fair assessment of the situation. I want to start off by saying that when I have these sort of conversations with families, I am going to talk to you the way I would want to be talked to if I was in your shoes, which is pretty direct. I don't find that it's very helpful to beat around the bush or to sugarcoat things, but my intention is certainly not to be unkind. So I hope that it doesn't come across that way. I hope it just comes across as giving you the unvarnished truth.
Yeah, that would be great. We don't know much yet.
Yeah. So your mom has some bleeding in her brain, what we call an interparenchymal hemorrhage. Just means there's blood within the brain tissue itself. And it's in an area that we commonly see bleeds like this develop, usually from things like longstanding high blood pressure. And sometimes maybe that is high blood pressure that is known, and sometimes it's unknown. So I usually say that to clarify, because people will jump in and say, well, she doesn't have high blood pressure, right? She takes her medicine, and, you know, that's fine, but damage can still be done over time.
Yeah, her blood pressure has always, it was high. I mean, she sees her doctor, they have a kind of on and off things, but she has had that.
Yeah, so tell me a little bit about her health. Does she have many health problems?
You know, yeah, she's getting older. She was used to be pretty, she was vigorous. She skied, she got into pickleball, but, a few years ago, sorry, they said she had dementia, which they thought was pretty mild. It seems like it's gotten a little worse. Her memory is kind of spotty now. She's, she'll a lot of time lose track of the day. A couple of months ago, she called me by my brother's name, but you mean she's okay. I live with her now, and I think she needs that to help out. But she does most of her own things when she's in her routine. So that's just, I think they said there's nothing to do about that. It just is what it is. Otherwise, blood pressure's been high. She had a heart attack 4 or 5 years ago. They put a stent in. That's, I guess, been okay since. What else? She had a skin cancer a while back on her face that they cut out. What else? I don't know. She smokes. She cut back, but I don't know. She gets around okay. I don't know. She fell last month and bumped her head. I don't know. Like, she's okay, but she's getting older,
Mm-hmm. Okay. So one reason to get into this, even if you know their history, right? So sometimes we don't know because it's a patient who's fairly new. We haven't really gotten a good history, but maybe we do. Maybe we have really a good detail history on her. I still like to have them explain to me, because it helps them to sort of frame what kind of health their family member is in. Because if I just start saying we know that she has a lot of health problems, they may or may not know that. Or they may have just never thought about it. And so frequently when they start talking about it like this all at once, it does sort of paint a picture for them of what her life is normally like.
It also gives kind of you may know a list of diagnoses, but not what it means. The word is functionally. What's their right. Functional status? What is their life actually like? And that's things like, they're sort of painting a picture of their quality of life, how able they are to do kind of things, you know, their activities of daily living and that sort of thing. And they're sort of gestalt of like, oh, you know, they haven't been doing so good, or they've been good, or that kind of, you can't really get that from looking at a chart usually.
Right. And that's what I was going to say. Brandon did a good job of, he went actually went in and explained kind of what she's able to do. But if they don't offer that, I usually will ask, like, you know, so what is she able to do? Is she, you know, reasonably independent? Can she, you know, dress herself without help? Can she, does she cook food for herself? Does she go out and drive, do shopping, et cetera? Because that also gives you a good idea, like you said, of the functional status of where they are. So, you know, right now she's on the ventilator, like you mentioned, and that's really to support her. She's not breathing as well as we'd like. And in addition, because of her brain injury, she's not able to protect herself very well. So you and I, we do things like clearing our throat, or even just the way we swallow when we go to take a drink that protects things from coming down into our lungs. And she's not able to really do that right now. So the ventilator is helping her to breathe, but also protecting her and keeping her safe while she's in this sort of depressed level of consciousness state.
Is she in a coma?
So coma is a kind of a difficult concept, but I would say no right now. She's just what we would call altered in terms of her level of consciousness. She could improve or she could not. Right now, we're very on in the process, very early on in the process.
Okay.
So usually at this point, people want to know sort of, you know, what's the prognosis? What is her chance for getting better? And, you know, looking at her scans, and we can look at her scans together if that would be helpful. Sometimes people like to see kind of what we're talking about. But looking at her scans and the extent of her bleeding, she has a pretty significant injury. I think given the degree of her injury combined with her previous health problems and her age, I think that what we're looking at is a situation where the chance of her having a really good recovery is not very good. So at this point, I think what you guys need to do as a family is sort of take some stock and think about what she values, what you guys value, and what she would sort of say is quality of life. Because I think that's what we really care about, right? It's not just how long we live, but how well we live. And quality of life is something that is, you know, difficult to describe and difficult to define, and it's sort of individualized. I've had patients who've told me before that if I have to live in a nursing home and someone has to bathe me and feed me and do all of the things for me, and I'm unable to do anything for myself, but I can recognize my family when they come to visit, and I can interact with them, and I can watch my favorite TV shows, then that's good quality of life. On the other hand, I've had people who have said, I live alone right now in my own home, and I do everything for myself, and I value my independence, and if I can't do that, then I don't want to continue living. That would be not quality for me.
You know, so he's saying, is she gonna die, or if she doesn't die, I mean, what's she gonna be like?
So right now, like I said, it's kind of early on in the process, so it's hard to say for sure. One of the hardest things in medicine is to sort of predict what people are gonna have, what kind of quality of life they're gonna have after an injury like this. What I usually like to do is to say, let's look at sort of best case scenario and worst case scenario, and then something in between is probably the most likely scenario. And oftentimes when we just sit down and describe the best case scenario, families may go, that the best case scenario is not good enough. She would not want that. And that makes a pretty easy decision, because you can say, no matter the outcome, it's not going to be something she would want. It gets a little trickier if we say best case outcome would be something she would accept. But is that really the most likely? So I think in her case, like I said, given the extent of her injury, given her previous issues and her age, I think best case scenario is she's going to have to live in a nursing home. She won't be able to come home. And she will require some sort of full-time skilled care.
Okay. So that's what, that's if she does well.
That's if she does well.
What if she doesn't?
If she doesn't do well, right now she's not on any sedation medicine, and she's on the ventilator breathing very comfortably. That sounds good, but it's actually a poor sign. The ventilator is not comfortable. As you can imagine, the tube going into your throat would be uncomfortable. The machine, the way it breathes, is not a natural way to breathe, and so it's not very comfortable. And so when I see someone who's not on any kind of sedation medicine but doesn't seem to mind being on the ventilator, it makes me concerned.
Concerned about?
That the level of her brain injury may be severe enough that she's not going to be able to come off the ventilator.
Okay. And then, I mean, what would, then what?
So if we couldn't get her to a point where she could safely come off the ventilator, we would have to talk about something called a tracheostomy, which is a surgical procedure where we make an incision in the throat, move that tube out of her mouth and put it directly into her windpipe through her neck. That would allow her to be on the ventilator. It would allow her to go to a facility where she could be maintained on a ventilator. She would also need what's called a surgical feeding tube at that point, and that's another surgical procedure where we just put a hole into her stomach, put a tube directly in there to give her food, medicine, things like that.
Okay. What if she didn't want that?
If she doesn't want, if she didn't want the tracheostomy and the feeding tube?
I mean, that sounds like a lot.
It is a lot. You know, and in a situation like this, I would say sometimes it's okay to do those things and they're temporary and people get better. Given your mom's age and given her medical problems that she had already, I think it's unlikely that she does get better. And I think if we get to the point where we say she's going to require that tracheostomy and feeding tube, it's probably going to be for the rest of her life.
Okay. I don't know. I mean, we never talked about this, of course. She had kind of said, you know, she had an uncle who had a stroke, and I think he had the breathing tube, and she had kind of said that was not the kind of life she would wanting. I think she said she would, you know, heroic thing. She didn't want any of that. But of course, we never saw this happening. So I don't know. What do we do now? I mean, what's next?
So I think this is a good point to make a point about talking about the ventilator. So I hear this a lot from families who say they would never want to be on a ventilator. Even times where I've had in situations just like this one, where that people would say, even right now, she would not want this. She would not want to be intubated. And I think this is a point where we need to do some clarification, because we sometimes understand this in medicine and sometimes we don't, but the lay public definitely doesn't, that there's very few things that are clearly black and clearly white. And so what I usually say is, you know, when your mom said that she wouldn't want to be on a ventilator, most people, when they say that, they mean for a prolonged period of time or the rest of their life. They don't want to be dependent on a ventilator. A lot of people would say, I don't want to be on a ventilator, but they'd be okay being on the ventilator for a short period of time. So, for example, if there was a problem that they could recover from that required them to be on the ventilator for a few days, they would be okay with that. And in this case, I think your mom is in a position where she could improve to the point that she could come off the ventilator. And I think maybe giving her some more time is something worth talking about.
Okay. So we wait and see for now.
So I think you have a couple of different options. So this is the other thing that I'm going to do, is I think that we in healthcare sometimes get afraid of making recommendations when it comes to things like this. We have a history in medicine of sort of making people's decisions for them. And I think sometimes the pendulum is swung too far the other direction and we say, well, I can't make that decision for you. But the sort of crude analogy that I always use is, if I took my car to the mechanic and the mechanic said, well, what do you want me to do? I would say, well, I'm not a mechanic. I don't know. What do you think I should do? Right? Does this need to be fixed or does it not need to be fixed? And the same thing I think applies here. So I'm going to make some recommendations of what I think would be good. And they're just recommendations. If you don't like them, that's fine. Right? This is not personal. You tell me we want to do something different and we'll do something different. And I will, within reason, do whatever you want me to do. Okay. I think at this point you have two options. Option one is to say, I don't think that this is going to have the outcome that she wants. And so knowing that now, I don't want to put her through anymore. And we can talk about something called comfort care. Option two is to say, I'm not convinced that she's not going to recover to a point that she would be okay with. Can we give her some more time? And I think that's a perfectly valid option as well.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I'd like to maybe talk to some of the other family, and it sounds like, you know, with a little time, we'll know better what's going to happen. I mean, well, how much time are we talking here?
So I would say we give her, if you wanted to give her some time to see if she's going to recover, I would say give her a couple of days. That'll give the chance for the swelling to go down in her brain, and we can see if she starts to improve. That'll also sort of give us an idea what, if she does start to improve, what degree of improvement we can expect.
Okay. Yeah, I think that sounds good.
Okay. So one thing I would like to talk about, though, while we're here is if, and this is a worst case scenario conversation, if she were to start rapidly to decline and got to the point where her heart stopped or she stopped breathing, she's already on the ventilator, but if her heart were to stop, would you want us to do CPR, potentially shock her heart, give her drugs and all those things in an effort to revive her? And I say that because at her age and with her health problems, if that were to happen, the odds of us being able to successfully resuscitate her and get her to a point even back to where she was, where she is like right now, is very poor.
I don't know.
Very frequently, I feel like I talk to people who say that, right? They go, I don't know. I've never really thought about it. And it's sort of it is sort of a big question to hit all at once. So I say that my thoughts are, if in doubt, we do everything. We can always change our mind later. If things start to go very poorly and we start looking like we're headed towards that, where she's going to need CPR and things like that, we can talk about it again. We can even start CPR and then you guys could say, okay, yeah, this doesn't feel right. Let's stop. But if we just say no now and you're not comfortable with that, then there's really not, you know, if something were to happen, we don't do anything. There's no way to kind of recover from that.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay. So then let's just recap to make sure that we're all on the same page here. So for right now, we're going to continue to do everything. We're going to continue to do repeat CAT scans and other blood tests. We're going to continue the ventilator. We're going to continue monitoring her and keeping her stable and give her another day or two to see if we have any recovery. Worst case scenario, if something were to happen, we'll do the full CPR and everything. And we can always revisit that at a later date if we need to. We'll give her a day or two and we'll sort of see how things go. If she has any big changes for the worse or for the better, we'll have this conversation again. But in the meantime, we'll sort of just give it some time.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So in the meantime, I would say that you as a family should be talking about these things and sort of be thinking, what does she value? What would she want? Does she have any non-negotiables? Like if this, that's a hard line, right? If I can't feed myself, I wouldn't want it. If I had to have a tracheostomy, I wouldn't want it. Things like that. If you can think of any hard lines that she would draw. And that way, when we have this conversation again, if we're still looking at this sort of, well, maybe she's going to get somewhat better, but we're still not sure she's going to fully recover, we can sort of have an idea as to what would be acceptable and not to her.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So I think that what I just did there is a really important point of this is to recap exactly what has been decided. I've had situations with myself and with colleagues where patients have been made DNR and the family didn't understand that that was what's going to happen. I've had times where the family thought they were very clear that they wanted to do hospice, but it was not clear. And several days later, they're like, I don't understand. Why are we still doing all these things? So I like to just take a second and say, okay, we've had this long conversation. Here are the bullet points to make sure we're all on the same page. And here's what I'm going to do, right? If the decision is comfort care, I'm going to go right now and I'm going to start putting in orders to stop tests, to stop medications. I'm going to add pain medicine. I'm going to, you know, things like that. Just to make sure, give everybody a chance to say, wait, that's not what I thought we were going to do.
Yeah, you don't want to be the MICU team rounding on hyponatremia and you like talk at length and then wander off and don't actually do anything. Because your goal here was to achieve something. And even right. if it's just moving towards a greater understanding, you want to, you know, have made some sort of progress. And if you don't kind of tie a knot in it, then you may have kind of wasted everyone's time.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point because I think a lot of times we think when you go to have a goals of care talk with a family, if you don't come out with, yeah, they want to withdraw, they want to go comfort, they want to go hospice, then somehow that you have failed, right? And that you have not had a resolution to the problem, especially if this is true when we as medical people look at the case and go, well, there's clearly one right decision here. And they didn't agree with me. But I don't think that's true because I think, you know, like you said, Brandon, if you've made progress, right? Maybe it's just setting the stage. Like in this scenario, family's sort of like, I don't know, this kind of came out of nowhere. I don't know what to do. But we've had the initial conversation, right? We've moved the ball down the field a little bit. We're not to the end zone yet, but we're getting there. And I think it's perfectly acceptable as an outcome to say, we had this conversation and nothing changed. We're still full code. We're still full court press, but we're going to come back and talk tomorrow again. And I don't think that is a failed goals of care.
No, yeah, I think that's extremely important because I think it is very easy to think that you're going into these conversations with a goal and your goal is to help somebody reach the right answer, which you clearly know. Right. But that implies that we care. Like, what is our stake in this? It's not right. our loved one who's dying.
Right.
And really our stake, I mean, really, to be completely honest, is probably that this case is kind of bumming us out. We don't think it's going to go well. This person's taking up our ICU bed, and we think that they should just kind of get with the program and let them die. That we do not have the same stake here. This is right. not some us or somebody that we love who is dying. So it's wrong, I think, if you walk in here with a goal of changing somebody's goals of care. Your goal should be having everyone reach a strong understanding of what's happening, what you believe to be the prognosis as best as you can understand it. And if they understand that, then if nothing changes, then it was successful. They know what's happening and they've like made a rational decision. You may or may not agree with, but what is agree? You wouldn't do the same thing for your mom. It's not your mom. I mean, that is
right. And people ask me that, well, what would you do if this was your mom? Well, it's not my mom. So I can tell you what I would do if it was my mom, but that may still not be the right decision for you. And that's why, like when I say I'm going to make some recommendations because I feel like families want recommendations. I'm going to make some recommendations, but this is not, yeah, right. This is not personal. This is not like I'm saying, well, you should do this. And if you disagree with me, you're wrong. I'm just saying these are some recommendations that I think would be good, but I fully understand if you don't agree with them, if you don't like them, it's not personal and it's not, well, you're wrong and I'm right and you should listen to me. I'm just giving you some options.
Well, and it's recommendation, and I think this is a helpful way to break it apart. Their role here is to know the patient who we just met and to communicate what they think their values and goals would be. Our role is to share medical advice on how to achieve those. So if we start weighing in on what their values should be, that's wrong, because that, how could we know that? And if they start weighing in on how to medically achieve them, that's also kind of wrong. So when you come in and focus on treatments and be like, well, what do you want? CPR, dialysis, a ventilator, BiPAP, do you want pressors, which one? You flipped it. That's our problem. Right. Their problem is to tell us what they're trying to achieve. And we say, well, in light of that, here's what I suggest doing.
Yeah, and that's why you see, like, I didn't make my recommendations right off the bat. I listened to Brandon tell me about what his mom values, what he wants. And then, having heard that, then I can make recommendations, right? So if he had said, she had an uncle, I've heard this before, right? I have an uncle who's on a ventilator. He lives in this facility, and I think she would think that was great. Then I would say, great. Well, we can certainly move forward with a trach and a peg, right? It's not my place to pass some sort of judgment on whether that's quality of life or not.
Right. And I guess the other two things I would highlight for this initial sort of a conversation is that it's almost the minority of cases, I would say, where on like day zero, you've just diagnosed the problem, got the patient stabilized, you're talking to the family, that you're going to make any major changes to your goals here, because it is the worst time to do that. They are the most shocked at what's going on. They're under stress. You don't have a lot of the data back, and you are trying to prognosticate at the worst possible time, because the best tool for prognostication is always time and seeing what happens. So you're trying to guess now with no trajectory. So the only times when I sort of push that and try to move a needle is when it's in the context of the chronic state, not the acute one. Mm-hmm. When the patient who comes in is already severely debilitated, they have like end-stage dementia, you know, they're at the late stage of a disease with a clearly understandable progression that's never going to get better, like you know what's going on, then it almost doesn't matter what happened today. The most important thing is the chronic part of it. And then it's easy to say, like, whatever, they may or may not get better from this pneumonia, but they were already dying. I mean, you can perhaps even say that. So it's really easy to prognosticate. When it's mostly an acute problem, let's say it's a young, healthy person in trauma or something, it's really hard to make those predictions, for me even, and then that much harder for the family to say what we should do about it. So they often are not ready to do anything, and I almost don't think they should be. Give it time, and that's often what, I mean, they often have kind of nothing to say. And then that lands you at kind of where I almost feel like the default plan or goals of care is, which is give it a trial, a time-limited trial of full critical care to see what happens. A few days is usually about right. And then revisit and see where they're at. And then most people, as a default, want all that stuff in the short term and maybe don't want permanent or long-term life support. That's what most people really want when you really get down to it. And that, so that all fits together. See if they're going to get better. If they're not, then you know a lot more in a few days. And that, if you may be in a place where they don't know what to do, and you can just lay out that option, and many people will be like, yeah, that sounds like what we want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is actually brings up something that I'm going to say that I think is a little bit controversial, in that I don't like living wills. On the one hand, they're great for someone has had a conversation about what they want and don't want. But on the other hand, it's usually in the context of a legal professional, not a medical professional, right? And a lot of times the ones I see are these sort of do-it-yourself templates that you can sort of check a box. I do want this, I don't want this. And very often the reality of the situation in front of you doesn't conform neatly to any of those boxes. Right, so I think a living will is great from the standpoint of it forces you to hopefully have a conversation. Right, hopefully you're not just downloading a legal Zoom living will, filling it out, and sticking it in a drawer and having never talked with your family about it. But I think ultimately what the best thing to do is to have someone that you can say, my son, my uncle, my brother, my neighbor, my college roommate, whoever it is that I trust to do this for me, and I've told them my wishes, who can then interpret what the team is telling them is going to happen, right? Because I've had people before who've said, yeah, I mean, it says right here, he does not want to be on a ventilator. Okay, but I mean, he has pneumonia, and if I don't intubate him, he's going to die. If I do intubate him and I give him 7 days of antibiotics, he'll probably be fine. But his thing says no ventilator.
Yeah. Is that what you think?
Is that really what he wants? Yeah. Is that what he meant when he said no ventilator? I would argue no, but I don't know him. Maybe he does. Maybe he has some, you know, weird objection to ventilators in general, right?
Yeah.
So.
And the other thing that comes up is people who have had no experience with this, their knowledge of it is, it's like based on maybe some peripheral interactions with friends or distant family, maybe like TV movies. So they almost have more misconceptions than conceptions. So it comes up with the language. You know, I asked, is this a coma? Words like life support, you know, is he on life support? They've like seen that in newspapers or whatever. I try to de-emphasize that sort of thing because the language doesn't matter. And saying, oh yeah, this is that or not that, is just going to call on whatever associations they have with words like that, which are probably not very contributory. So I just focus on like what, here's what we're actually dealing with here. It doesn't really matter what we call it.
Yeah.
This is the situation.
Well, and we all call things different. I had a patient one time, not a funny situation, right? The patient was on VA ECMO, dialysis, CRRT, running through the ECMO circuit, on the ventilator, on multiple vasopressors. And the team came in to put a small bore feeding tube in, a nasal duodenal tube in. And the family flipped out. What are you doing? We're putting this tube in so we can give him nutrition and medicine and stuff. No, absolutely not. He would not want to be on life support. And, you know, I say it's not a funny situation because it's somebody's, you know, it's a real person, but it's funny to medical people who are like, what do you imagine is going on right now? Right? This is literally the most life support there is, but you're drawing the line at a feeding tube. That's a temporary feeding tube at that. So I think, like you said, people have their misconceptions of what things are and aren't. And, you know, maybe they never heard of ECMO, so they don't know what it is, but they've heard of feeding tube.
Yeah.
And that's what keeps those coma people alive who really shouldn't be, right? You know, so
they'll stare at the vital screen and then be like, oh, the blood pressure is high or something. Like that's something they have experience with.
Right.
Whereas in our setting, it's not a big
right.
deal.
People ask all the time, when should I be concerned? You should not even look at that monitor, sir.
Yeah.
I cannot teach you, you know, 5 years of school and 20 years of experience in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, so you let me worry about the medicine. You worry, like you said, this is a team effort. Your job is to know what they would want, and my job is to help you get there.
Yeah. A couple other things. Brian, a few times, used the phrase doing everything, which is a quick way to summarize the sort of aggressive life support stuff that you're often doing initially. Some folks in the palliative care world try to avoid language like that because it sort of has the implication that if you, the alternative is doing less, which is literally true, but doing worse. You know, it's worse care, which is not the message you want to send. You want to send the message that no matter what happens, we're going to give the person the best care. Just a question of how that care is oriented. So some of the language here is delicate because if you'd make a patient, you know, comfort measures, you literally will be doing less.
Yeah.
But it's not qualitatively less, it's just quantitatively less.
Yeah, and that's a good point. I do try to usually avoid saying things like withdraw care, right? We say that a lot in medicine, meaning withdrawal of life-sustaining therapy, which is what you'll hear palliative care say. But we say withdraw care, it implies that we're going to stop taking care of the patient, which is not true. We're just changing the direction of the care. We're changing the type of care. So it is important that we do that. The other thing, you know, when you said do everything, yeah, that did sort of trigger something with me that I usually try to avoid, which is offering things that we don't want to do, right? And so this is, surgeons are famous for this, coming in and saying without surgery, they will die. But with surgery, they will almost certainly not survive the surgery. What that family just heard is, they have a 99% chance of dying in surgery and a 100% chance of dying without surgery. that means surgery, they have a chance of surviving. So if you do not feel like surgery is a good option, right? The risk outweighs the benefit, et cetera. Do not offer the surgery. I have some nephrologists who I think are wonderful at this, and I will call them sometimes just because I know they will do this, who will say, we're not going to offer dialysis, period, right? The patient will not survive without dialysis. We're not going to offer dialysis because they're not a good candidate for dialysis. It's not going to make a difference, right? When you offer something and then take it away by saying, but it's not a good idea, the family, all they hear is, we could do this, and it's better odds than doing nothing. So why not?
But you won't. But you then won't. It's like, why? Oh, yeah. Like,
and there's lots of good reasons, right? Lots of good reasons why we're not going to take somebody to the operating room who's not going to survive, right? Some of them are sort of crass in terms of metrics and money and resources, but some of them is the very real moral distress that you're going to put the OR team through with a patient who is most likely going to die on the table, right? Which is just not a good way to go. And, you know, I wouldn't want to die in the operating room if I could die in a bed with my family around, right? And same thing, I wouldn't want my loved one to die in the operating room if I knew that it was futile care.
Yeah. I guess the last point I would emphasize is that these conversations are a process. And that is why typically they take time. And that means time over time, a longitudinal relationship almost. And it's for many reasons. One, like we said, is to allow the case to unfold and to help you prognosticate. One is to give the family time to come to terms with it and figure out what their own thoughts and kind of wrap their head around what's happening, maybe talk amongst themselves. One is to help you guys maybe establish a little bit of a rapport. Because if you just like blow in there in the hottest time and are like, your mom's gonna die, let's killer. They're not gonna believe that you are like coming from a place where you're looking out for their best interest. So assuming that, you know, on your first conversation, maybe nothing is gonna happen or change, and being okay with that. Again, your goal is not to get the DNR or whatever you're trying to do here. Your goal is to help them understand what's going on and make sure you're doing what they, not even they want, what they think the patient would want. Mm-hmm. That's your goal. And realistically, early on, that they are not going to want to change much. So, you know, on day zero like this, my expectation would be that not much is changing. But we started the conversation and then laying a groundwork like we've talked about for what's next so that you have made some kind of progress. You're not starting from scratch later, but you're moving in that direction. That's why, you know, when you involve palliative care, it's almost, you could say the negative stereotype is like nothing ever happens. They just keep chatting with this family every day for like 6 weeks. But that's because in that case, the family didn't want to change anything. Right. Now, I do think sometimes it's appropriate to be a little more aggressive with like making a recommendation, and maybe sometimes we're better situated to do that than another service like palliative. But it's very delicate. It's like playing blackjack. If you push too hard on anything and they start to lose trust in you or feel like you're pushing them to kill their mom. I mean, that's what we're getting down to here. You can't like pull back from that. So you really like, you need to err on the side of like, take your time, because again, this, you're just trying to get things done and get your checklist. This is a big deal to them. So.
Yeah, exactly. And I would say when it comes to consulting palliative care, I do not believe in calling palliative for every case like this. I think that the majority of these cases where the situation is fairly cut and dried, the ICU team should be able to handle that themselves. This is not a knock on palliative. This is actually a supporting palliative. They have too much work to go around. And so if we can take some of the minor stuff off their plate, I think it helps them. It helps us as well. And it helps the family. Because the family, in this case, the scenario we just presented, we just met. But most of the time in the ICU, when you're having this conversation, like Brandon said, it's an ongoing series of conversations. You're building rapport with this family. Maybe you've already built rapport, right? Maybe the patient came in and it was pretty clear from the get-go, like you were even on board with, no, we got to do everything, right? This patient is young and healthy, a trauma patient, for example, and 2 weeks in, it becomes clear that they're not going to survive or not going to have a good outcome, and you're going to switch gears and start having that conversation. you've put in 2 weeks with the family of building that rapport, asking palliative to come in to just deliver the bad news is really not fair to anybody. And so I think that we should be taking that on ourselves. Now, I will say I have come around on the idea of involving hospice more. So I think that I used to say, you know, I have my palliative care conversation. I'll put my palliative care hat on and do that. And then I can put the comfort care orders in. I can manage their symptoms because they're probably going to die today or tonight. And if they're still around tomorrow, then we'll call hospice. But frankly, hospice offers a lot of other benefits to families that we can't do in the ICU, including postmortem benefits. And so I think that it's probably a good idea to offer that when a family says, I want to proceed with comfort care, to offer some sort of hospice intervention, depending on what you can do in your facility.
Yeah, and many facilities will want you to do that anyway because it gets the death off their own books. But palliative depends everywhere on their availability and culture and stuff. It makes the most sense to me when the situation is more about chronic stuff, both pre-admission chronic states and a longer-term post-discharge chronic state, because that's more their deal. I don't leave the ICU. I don't know anything outside of critical illness. But when there's a lot more to unpack there, oh, they've been getting worse from their myasthenia. Oh, this is what their like dispo could look like. That's more their realm. Something like this, day one, a big bleed, that's pure critical care. Like, yeah. This is all our thing. So involving someone else, there's going to become a middleman. Like, they need to have a deep sense of the critical illness side of it to even do a good job. So I'm going to have to try to transmit that to them, and then they're going to have to try to transmit it to the family. So why don't we just do that? That's right in our realm. Now, when it becomes more about, well, then they had their stroke 3 years ago and their stroke last year, and now they haven't been able to walk, but they always kind of, they didn't want, that is more of that big picture stuff, which I'm not saying we can't do, but that is more their wheelhouse. I mean, palliative care happens outside the ICU, in the clinic, on the floors. That's all the stuff that we don't do. So That makes more sense to me.
I would say to look at calling palliative care like you would look at calling any consult, right? I'm not going to call cardiology for garden variety AFib. I can manage that. I am going to call cardiology when I have AFib that I cannot break. I have tried everything and it is causing problems and we're having to get into medicines that I'm uncomfortable with. Or if they are going to require follow-up, right? They need somebody to follow them. You know, I'm perfectly comfortable managing someone's blood sugars in the ICU, but if their A1C is 15 and they're on a ton of insulin, it's pretty clear they're going to need some help after they leave the ICU. So I'm going to call endocrine.
Right.
You know,
maybe these conversations you start here are going to continue, right?
Right.
And I'm not going to have them once they leave the ICU. So that's an important part too. Just like nephrology will keep an eye on their AKI on the floors and maybe after discharge, so too can palliative, and this longitudinal conversation can continue for days, weeks, months, whatever.
Yeah. So I think complexity of the situation or the need for follow-up is the two kind of big buckets of reasons to call palliative.
Okay. Gosh, what else should we say about this?
I like I said, this is something that is a real interest of mine. I think it is a very difficult conversation to have, but the more you do it, the easier it becomes. And I think that's one reason that people don't do it is because it's uncomfortable. And then they say, but it's always uncomfortable. Right. It's going to be uncomfortable. It gets better. It gets easier to do. Does it ever completely become easy? No, right? I still have conversations 10 years in to doing this with families that I leave and go, I've got to go sit in a quiet room for a minute because that was a hard, hard conversation. But it does become easier.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess the points I would leave with are, this is hard, it's complicated, and it warrants your attention at mastering it as much or more, really, truly more than most of the procedures and things you do in the ICU. It is a good time to be careful, if that's the word. Careful choosing your words, careful how you interact, and that could be all the way down to like comb your hair, man. You've been up all night. Like,
yeah. You know,
like put
I used
on
to put my white coat on.
Yeah.
Specifically for these people knew if they ever saw me in the white coat in the hospital, they were like, oh, are you on your way to have a conversation?
These people don't know you. They're not like, oh, that's Brandon, the like frumpy genius. They're like, who is this joker?
Frumpy genius.
Yeah. Be careful prognosticating, because you can't take back if you're wrong about something, but you know, time is always the best tool here, and rarely is another day or whatever wrong. What's the worst case? They spend some more healthcare dollars or something like that. Like that's rarely wrong. And I think try to take your personal bias out of it, because we it's hard to avoid that and start to feel like, oh, this guy is still here. The family needs to get on board and make this guy CMO or something like that. Mm-hmm. That's not your role.
Yeah.
You're putting yourself into this situation in a trivial sort of self-serving way. Just because you're tired of writing the same progress note or something like that. Mm-hmm. That's not our what we're supposed to be doing here. The one exception I'll say is that we do live in a world where healthcare resources are finite, and you could argue that some of these people with poor outcomes are not a good use of those resources, but that's generally not playing a big role in what we do in the United States in 2025. Yes. Other countries, for sure. In a few years when we're all running out of money, maybe then. But if you're not, you know, making decisions that way in general, don't suddenly start making them that way when a case is boring you.
Yeah. And I would say you made a really good point when you talk about be careful about prognostication. I typically tell families, I never say always and I never say never. But when I have something that I really believe like is always, I will say this is as close as I feel to saying that, right? Could something happen? Absolutely. Right? Could a miracle happen? Could something that we don't, you know, I don't have a crystal ball. I can't predict, but this is as close to that as I feel comfortable saying. Because if nothing else, if you say absolutely this is what's going to happen and it doesn't happen, then you've ruined your credibility with that family. And why should they listen to you? Because you told me 100% that this was going to happen and it didn't.
Yeah. I'll say things like, it's possible that you walk out of the hospital today and get struck by lightning, but I wouldn't make my plans based around that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I think especially if you're dealing with certain populations who have historically kind of been screwed by the system. I see this in a lot of people of color, a lot of ethnic minorities who have a lot of reason to distrust the government, the system, whatever. But you just don't want to take care of my loved one for whatever reason, right? So I think you have to be mindful of that, especially when you start making bold claims.
Right. And yeah, that's another aspect of being cautious. Cautious with how what you're saying is coming across. So take your time, feel them out. And you know what the palliative folks do a lot is asking permission. Mm-hmm. You know, say, is it okay if we talk about the case and what I think is going on? Can I share with you, you know, my sense for what's going to happen? Can I make a suggestion for where we go from here? And that puts in their camp. And generally, they'll say yes. I mean, they're not going to be like, no, like, piss off. But it makes sure that they're on board with things and that you're not coming across as forcing anything down their throat.
Yeah. One thing that I forgot to mention that I do when I have these conversations is sit down. Right. Find a place where you can sit down. If it's in the patient's room, fine. If the patient is kind of not able to participate, but maybe not hears you, and the family says, I don't want to have this conversation in front of them, that's fine. Find a place, but find a place where you can sit and have a discussion without being interrupted. Studies have shown that if you sit down, people perceive that you've spent more time with them than you actually did. And, you know, we've just been saying here, one of the big pitfalls is people saying, well, you're just tired of taking care of my father. You know, you're trying to rush me to make a decision. People say that all the time. I feel pressured to make this decision. So if you sit down and take your time, they will feel less of that. It will give the appearance, at least, that you're not in a hurry and that you're not trying to get them to come to a decision because time or whatever.
Right. And talking regularly too, you know, every day having some kind of conversation, because avoid surprises helps them kind of incrementally move towards understanding. And avoid, I mean, how can they say you don't care? Like, look, I've been here all week, man. We've been talking every day. This, I'm you know, invested in this too. I just want to make sure that, and oftentimes, you know, every time you talk, it doesn't have to be trying to force a decision, but just sharing what's going on. And you're saying, you can, on, you know, transparently say, you know, I still don't know what's going to happen, but I tell you, it's been 3 days. I'm getting more and more worried that they're not going to get much better, or, you know, that those sorts of things. Like, trying to have them have the same general understanding of the case as you and the team, not have these situations where they're like, oh, I guess everything's fine, and then every team is writing a note saying this patient's going to die or something like that. Like, I mean, communicate these things so they kind of, doesn't mean you have to change what you're doing, but this is what we're sort of thinking, you know?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's that. We'd love to hear more from you guys about this conversation. There is some good resources in the palliative care world for those who are interested. I'm trying to think off the top of my head.
Center for, what is it? Center for some, it's CAPC. I can't remember what the A stands for. Has a website. We'll put it in the show notes. Has lots of great resources on this.
Yeah, the Conversation Project is a website that's I think especially meant for families to talk amongst themselves, but kind of unpack some of these things. There are courses, sim things that are that go into stuff. Of course, some of it you have to pay for, but I mean, shit, man, if you're gonna pay for a course, it'd probably be better served doing this than learning how to do ECMO or something.
Yeah,
you can do it more often.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
all right, cool beans. We'll talk to you guys next time.
See ya.